Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. This week's podcast is about the presidential election that starts Friday and ends on Sunday, March 17th. It's essentially a non-competitive process that is set to hand President Vladimir Putin a new six-year term in the Kremlin. There's really no doubt about that, for reasons I'll get into a bit shortly, but we'll be talking about what the election could mean and what Putin's fifth term may look like. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Sergei Medvedev, a Russian historian and analyst who teaches at Charles University here in Prague. Sergei is a longtime contributor to RFERL, who hosts the Russian service's weekly video talk show, Archaeology, and he's the author of several books, including A War Made in Russia, which was published last year. Thanks very much for joining me, Sergei.
Hello, Steven.
All right, it's great to have you on the show. I'm happy to welcome you as a first-time guest. Now, my first question is essentially, does this election matter, and does the result matter? As I mentioned a minute ago, it's clear that Putin will secure a fifth presidential term. His victory is certain for a number of reasons, some of which go back 20 years to his first term. That's when the Kremlin began, actually more than 20 years, when the Kremlin began to strengthen its control over the media, particularly Russia's main TV channels, and its control over billionaire tycoons known as the oligarchs. And it's also when the state began pushing the political opposition to the margins, essentially starting a campaign to silence dissent that has intensified dramatically in the past decade since Putin's return to the presidency in 2012, and particularly in the last 2 years since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now, other reasons this election is kind of predetermined are more recent. Boris Nadezhdin, whose would-be candidacy began to look dangerous for Putin a couple months ago, has been barred from the ballot, which is quite an expected move. Not dangerous in terms of a threat to defeat Putin, but because thousands of people who lined up to support his candidacy showed that a significant number of Russians are desperate for an alternative. And of course, Alexei Navalny, who was barred from challenging Putin for the presidency in 2018, died in prison last month under suspicious circumstances that remained unexplained. His relatives and supporters say that he was killed by Putin. And again, there were long lines, you know, tens of thousands of people turned out for his funeral, another kind of indication of that there is among some Russians a desire for an alternative. So Putin will win. Sergei, my question is whether this election matters and whether there's anything about it that could matter, the turnout figure, the extent of evidence of fraud, for example, or the official result. Is Putin awarded 60, 70, 80% or more? Is there anything about the election that you believe is important to watch?
Thank you, Stephen. This election matters and doesn't matter at the same time. First, let us get clear about the terms. There's no such thing as elections in Russia, in today's Russia. With some approximation, you could talk about the elections in the 1990s, when Russia was an electoral democracy and there were unpredictable electoral outcomes, like 1996 election of Yeltsin against Gennady Zyuganov, the communist leader. This time, it's rather a plebiscite. It's a plebiscite about Putin, and even more so, it's a plebiscite about war. Putin wants a resounding endorsement of his war with Ukraine, with the West, and basically a world war to remake the world order. So, and it looks likely that he is set to get an approval of this war, and there are many indicators saying that the targeted approval rating of the war is like 80%. I mean, that's the vote turnout, but in fact, it's not about the election. So Putin is not really a president. I would say he is more of a tsar, seen as a tsar, a traditional leader for the majority of the population. And he is like the godfather the man who decides, the man who just pulls the strings for the elite of his close encirclements. But he is in no means a president in a political sense. So you see, Russia is a country of appearances, a country of misnomers. So if our listeners are thinking that there are elections in Russia which are going to be, a Russian president is going to be elected, this is wrong, right? So as to the result, I think for the presidential administration, it's like the testing. It's like a big poll, and they want to test the mood of the electorate. But on the other hand, this is also a test for the administrative machine. Each time the administrators are competing for the right figures and for the better figures. So as in any administrative and command system, they are vying for resources. And their resources are dependent on the result. Therefore, the regional electoral commissions, the regional administrators will be just, pooling the numbers, will be increasing the numbers of their respective regions. For instance, that I have the better turnout, I have the better result than the neighboring region. So we will see this sort of a, funny tug of war between the various administrators and electoral officials. So yes, in a nutshell, I mean, this doesn't matter that it will not change the course of Russia, this election. Russia is on the course to war. These elections are not about changing anything. But this is rather an election of approval. It will rather fix Putin in his current position and consolidate his place as the leader of the pack and as the leader of the wartime nation.
Okay, thank you, Sergei. Just a couple to follow up on a couple of things. You mentioned this kind of competition between officials to get out the vote and to however they may do it, to show high turnout and high results for Putin. And I've seen at some point, I think his spokesman Peskov, he may have misspoken, but he said Putin could easily get, I think, 90 or 95% mm-hmm. of the vote. Today, I saw a report on TASS that said, I think, one of the state-funded polling agencies reported that Putin could receive more, or 82% or more of the mm-hmm. vote. So does that sort of send a signal of what the Kremlin is looking for in terms of the result?
Yeah, exactly. Already for several months, several analysts with access to the presidential administration were indicating the figure of 80%, mm-hmm. which will satisfy the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. This is not yet the 99% Chechen turnout or the like Belarusian turnout, which are like a caricature autocracies, these two. So Russia does not yet want to graduate to this class. I think they will, as we say in Russia, they will draw the figures. Mm-hmm. Usually with the elections, expression is рисовать цифры, to draw the figures. So they will be drawing the figures closer to the 80s.
And I guess we've seen in the past there have been studies and demographers who have indicated, 10 million potentially made-up votes for Putin in mm-hmm. past elections. But another question just following up on that. You mentioned that, this you don't consider this an election. It shouldn't be considered an election. But on the other hand, the Kremlin and Putin are not going for these kind of 99%, 105% figures mm-hmm. that you see in some countries.
146, as yeah. they once had it in Russia, that became a meme. It's true, 146%.
So, does that indicate, and Putin, of course, I mean, the reason he can run in this election is that he engineered changes in the Constitution that essentially kind of...
It allows him to stay another further 2 terms.
They zeroed out his existing terms. I mean, he was president for 2 terms from 2000 to 2008, and then for 2 terms from 2012 to this year. Mm-hmm. But the way it was done, the way it's always been done, he became prime minister for 4 years in order to avoid violating the Constitution, and then he had the Constitution changed. But he's always kind of abided by whatever the law is in terms of, I mean, aside from fraud, but abided by the Constitution in terms of he's not saying I'm ruling for life or I'm just going to be president as long as I want. Is there some kind of indication that he and the Kremlin are still interested in this kind of veneer of democracy, and why does it even matter to them?
I think it's more for themselves. It's a matter of self-satisfaction, exactly preserving a veneer. Because Russia is about veneers, right? It's a one big Potemkin village, as was aptly observed. And it remains in every small, you know, walk of life. Russian army is a veneer, as we have seen this in the early attack on Ukraine, in the early months of the attack on Ukraine. And for instance, on the 9th of May, on the Victory Day, they are building a veneer Reichstag in this, you know, patriot theme park, military theme park, and the Soviet troops are attacking the veneer Reichstag, I think, which is a good metaphor in a reenactment of the action. I don't think there's any indication that they are going to follow the law. What they're going to do is that they're going to bend the law so that it looks, it appears as legal. But in fact, they need it just for their own, administrative purposes and merely for their satisfaction. There's no need in this. Putin, something prevents him from becoming an all-out dictator, whatever, African style, Trujillo style. If he wished, I mean, he could proclaim himself a tsar. And I think the Russian propaganda could have worked it through. The Russian population would have, you know, voted for the something like abolition of the constitution, for instance, that Russia becomes a monarchy or a constitutional monarchy. So theoretically, everything is possible. But he doesn't need it, so he just, you know, pushes the limit. First he follows the constitution, then he changes the constitution, he bends the constitution, so he follows the rules which he himself sets. It's like, as I said, he is very much understood as a criminal leader and a godfather. And the godfather also follows a certain law, a certain rules. So they have to be rules which are understood by the elite. So although these rules are about, you know, bending other people's wills and about killing other people, but there are certain rules to be followed. So therefore, he creates the rules for himself, which have nothing to do with constitutionalism, with republicanism, with the opinion of the people, of the population. But he creates his own rules, which he follows.
That's an interesting point, Sergei. Now, my second question is more, we've talked about sort of the mechanics of the election. My second question is more about the future, about the consequences of the election for Russia, for Russians, and about what Putin's fifth term may look like. Obviously, Russia is in the midst of once, I would say, unthinkable war against Ukraine, which you mentioned as being kind of a driving force of what Putin wants out of the election, an indication, at least a show, or something they can present as a show of overwhelming support for the war, and also Russia's in the midst of a spiraling clampdown on dissent at home in Russia, which, as I mentioned earlier, has kind of intensified quite a bit. I would say first after Navalny's arrest when he returned to Russia in January 2021, and then with the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. So what I'm interested in, I guess, Sergei, is your thoughts on what, if anything, might change and how the situation may develop in the coming months and even the next few years in terms of the war, Russia's relations with the West, and the circumstances faced by Russians as the rule of Putin, who in August will have been president or prime minister for 25 years, is set to continue.
Well, there are two questions here. First is about Putin's plans and the possible trajectory of the regime. And I think it's like weather forecast. You're better off if you say that tomorrow is going to be like today. I mean, you have a very high degree of probability there. So I would say my prediction would be like that. I think we're just more of the same. More of a totalitarian, and we have now to say it's no longer authoritarian, it's a totalitarian rule, because people need not just stay silent. You have to speak up. People are forced to speak, forced to denounce their neighbors and co-workers and show activity. So this, I think, the main difference between authoritarianism and totalitarianism. So we'll get more of this totalitarian practices in the society, in the repressive apparatus, in culture, in the silencing or eliminating the opponents. There'll be more of the same confrontation with the West and more of, you know, alliance with various Eastern powers. We'll see already Iran and Korea and becoming a vessel of China. So this Asian turn of Russia is almost complete. Russia is becoming an Asian country in many ways, in culture, eventually I think also in religion. There will be more of an Islamic component, and also in terms of political alliances. So the European, the Western period in the history of Russia has ended after 300 years. There will be more of the war, more of mobilization, more of war rhetoric. There'll be probably new fronts of this war. So this is as far as the regime is concerned, and Putin's personal power and his cleansing of the elite and the entire political setup of the country. As for the population, you know, I'll say maybe sort of sounds strange or cynical. It doesn't really matter. Russian population is in a condition that they, the weak endure what they have to endure. They endure what they must. The strong do what they will, and the population endures what it must. It has shown over decades. The Russian population may, of course, have some discontent. May be some displays of protest, some really minimal protest activity by the few brave activists. But en masse, the population, once again, I know it sounds weird, but they are not a game changer. They are a background against which any future change may take place. But the change comes from the top, from the leadership, when the leader dies, when the leader is killed, when the leader is, you know, ousted in a coup, as happened with Khrushchev and Brezhnev. Most likely when the leader dies, as we have seen so many times in Russian history, was the death of Stalin, was the death of Chernenko, and the coming of Mikhail Gorbachev, and so on. Or as a result of a coup, like happened in 1991. So, in this sense, the change may come from the side. It can be imposed by a external force. Russia has been so many times ruled and remade externally. Let's remember that the Russian statehood began as an imposed rule, mm-hmm. either by the Vikings in the 8th and 9th century, or by the Tatars later on. And then Russia was ruled by the German dynasty. So they're always the outsiders imposing their rule upon the nation, which eventually becomes the internal, the sovereign rule. But the outsiders do play a role. Or a military defeat. You know, a military defeat has always served this country good, I have to say. Like in the Crimean War, Having lost the Crimean War, Russia started a much-needed change. With the loss of the Crimean War and the eventual death of the Emperor Nicholas II, Russia embarked on very vigorous reform. Losing the war in Afghanistan. Also, it's only 6 months before the lost Russian tanks left Afghanistan and the fall of the Berlin Wall. So a defeat in a war serves Russia good. So what we need for a change in Russia is a change at the top, a change in the elite, involvement of the external power, or a loss in the war. I'm not talking about the, you know, arrival of extraterrestrials, some other mystic forces at play, Deus ex machina. But the Russian population, it becomes a factor once the change begins. Once mm-hmm. the change is announced at the top, then the Russian population comes in, as we saw in the Soviet Union in the late 80s. So once they allow free speech, once they start publishing stuff in newspapers, then the people are easily recruited. But it's not the people themselves that started the change. It's not the people themselves that started the movement, neither in the 1917 revolution nor in the 1999 revolution. Unfortunately, it was the historical pattern. It's a historical pattern of a nation that has been really destroyed by slavery. And that still is in a rather slavish condition. People are enslaved by the state in Russia.
This is a bit of a broad question, but you're touching on pretty broad themes. You mentioned here that the people, I guess, not in so many words, but people are not kind of an actor. They don't have a voice, much of a voice in what's happening. In particular, in terms of the ability to create change, do you see a time when the Russian state might exist to serve the Russian people? Did this happen in the 90s? Did it happen for some time, and then get reversed, or not? And is it sort of a possibility in the future? How far in the future?
It has to be a different state. Certainly not the state that has emerged historically in that territory, in that country, over the centuries. In this sense, the Russian state was never at the service of the Russian people. It was always a parasitic state. There was a state against the people. The state was this proverbial, classical Hobbesian Leviathan, oppressing and killing and using people as a resource. It was a more, let's say, vegetarian state in the 1990s, but that's not because it was strong, it was weak. The state has receded, the state has retracted in the 1990s, and that allowed people some space for individual freedom, for building up their life projects, political, economic, social initiatives. So that's how Russia, as we know it today, has emerged. It's a market economy, it's a market country, therefore Russia is, sort of say, surviving in the midst of war because the market is working, the market which was born there in the 1990s. But the state itself, I have yet to see a benevolent active and proactive and republican and citizen-oriented state in Russia. Once again, now, listeners have to understand that, once again, the state, as we know it in today's world, is not the right word for the Russian state. Mm. It's probably a mafia clan, a group of racketeers that have usurped the nation's resources. And the population is excessive. The population is not necessary. People are necessary as just the biomass to stuff the trenches in Avdiivka. Somewhere in the line of contact in Donbass in Ukraine. But otherwise, the state is really a group of people, several million people with their guardians that have taken stock of the national resources, basically sit on the pipeline and monopolize the pipeline and speak on behalf of the nation. But they're not people. This is not the mechanism for the people and of the people, right? So the Russian state is just a parasitic enterprise.
And Navalny had the comment about the toad sitting on the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, thanks very much. That's fascinating. I want to try to ask about the war in a somewhat specific way, if you don't mind. You mentioned kind of in passing that there could be more mobilization after the election, you know, after Putin secures his win. Is there, you know, and that's something that they've obviously been afraid, essentially, the Kremlin's been afraid to do since the initial, what they call the partial mobilization in September 2022. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think there are analysts who say they may be emboldened and then we'll go for it after the election or once Putin's first new term starts in May. So do you see this as sort of a distinct possibility, but also more broadly about the war? Obviously you mentioned that for Putin, for the Kremlin, the point of the election is to secure what will look like, firm and overwhelming mandate for the war, which is against Ukraine, but also is proclaimed to be against the West. Do you see any kind of chance of Putin, of Russia kind of adjusting its goals? Putin has maintained many times that the goals remain the same, and that includes denazification of Ukraine, which essentially means Russia taking over Ukraine or bringing it to its knees, having a Russia-loyal government in place. But do you see any, on the other hand, military analysts say there's little chance that, despite the gains that it's making now, there's not much of a chance that Russia can threaten Kyiv again, that sort of thing. So do you see a time when Putin or Russia may be willing to essentially negotiate on something other than, something less than its own real terms?
Okay, once again, there are two questions. Let me tackle them one by one. First, on mobilization. By saying mobilization, I meant rather, like in a broader sense, right, the mobilization of the national culture and economy and resources and people staying alert and staying loyal. As to the mobilization to the Russian army, I think so far they have solved the issue. Mm-hmm. They've really, economically, it's an amazing mechanism. A fellow economist, Vladislav Inozemtsev, called it death-onomics, necronomics. They're exchanging people's bodies for the oil money. Russia is still making a lot of oil revenue. Basically, I think the figure is for last year is like $350 billion in oil revenue, and the cost of war is in the area of $150, $170 billion. So basically, for $2 that Russia gets from its, not just oil, but raw materials from energy resources. So for $2 that Russia gets for its energy resources, they spends only $1 on war. And there's still money left. So it's a very profitable mechanism for Russia. So as long as the world learns how to sanction Russia and how to avoid buying Russian oil and gas and raw materials, so the war will be going on forever because it's a very profitable mechanism for Russia. And then, just like oil, Putin has found an inexhaustible supply of human flesh, of human meat. People are still lining up at the military precincts, at the call stations, because the benefits that are paid for the conscripts, not just for conscripts, but for contract soldiers,
right,
if you sign up, they're just amazing by Russian standards. People have never heard this of such sums in Russia. And you have to understand that it's not just Moscow and St. Petersburg. There's a huge country beyond that is totally impoverished and in credit. Russia overcredited. So suddenly you're giving a life chance for paying off the debt, moving up. And another thing is that life in Russia is very cheap. People do not value their life too high. It's, once again, sounds paradoxical, but many people are ready to die. Or, well, not just ready to die, but to risk their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Russia is a risk-taking country. Russians are taking big risks when driving, when drinking, when working, the work ethic, the work safety, so on is very low in Russia. So Russia has tens of thousands of people just, you know, killed in road accidents, further tens of thousands through drinking and through various all other accidents. Male expectancy in Russia is now below 60 years, average male expectancy. Mm-hmm. So Russian males do not even live up to the pension age. It's a very good situation for the state. So, and in this sense, Putin does not need immobilization. He can still count on this fresh inflow of people in the regions where people sign up for war. So that's one part. Another part is, what is the goal of the war, adjusting the goal? Mm-hmm. You know, the paradox of the situation that we do not know the goal of the war. Mm. The goal was never announced. Now they're not talking about denazification and demilitarization. There was talk in the first months, but they're not talking about this. They're not talking about the liberation of the Russian people of Donbas either. So I think the war has no goal. The goal of the war is war. Mm. It just has to continue because, as I mentioned, it's a very profitable mechanism for Putin. It's his mechanisms of governance. And he is going to use this election as the further approval of the war, as the national referendum about the war. So even if at some point he appears to be ready for peace negotiations, I think it's a temporary relief. Russia will be gathering its forces before striking again and again and again. Because what it wants is just not Ukraine. It wants all of its former sphere of influence. Putin made no secret about it. It wants the world. It wants a different world in which Russia is given, you know, a better place. So in this sense, Putin is not just fighting a, you know, colonial war somewhere far from Europe, far from the United States. Putin is a Hitler of today. Putin is a man who is bent on changing the international order. But the difference from the World War II is that this time he has a nuclear weapon in his hands. So it's really, the situation is as dangerous, as precarious, and what is at stake is global security and the survival of the human civilization, of global security and the human civilization. So we're seeing a paranoid guy with all these weapons. So yes, he will be fighting the war as long as he's alive. The war will probably end when Putin dies or is demoted, but then we also don't know who comes in his lieu.
All right. Well, it looks like he will be in power. Well, on that note, we're going to wrap it up.
Sorry for being so pessimistic and ending up on such a threatening note. But you know, I have no word of consolation.
No, just kind of hope people around the world and understand these things. Or come to understand them in the near future. So we'll wrap it up here. And thanks very much for joining me, Sergei.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right. Once again, I've been speaking to Sergei Medvedev, a Russian historian and analyst who teaches at Charles University in Prague, a longtime contributor to RFERL, who hosts the Russian Service's weekly video talk show, Archaeology, and the author of several books, including A War Made in Russia, which was published last year. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.